Well, in any election season, and we've just come out of one, you know how all of the rhetoric sort of ramps up and the brochures start flying and filling up your mailbox. And those of you who are in leadership, whether in the church or in the marketplace, can sympathize with political candidates on both sides of the aisle simply because you understand the impossibility of being able to fully defend your record and your reputation. I was reminded of this all over again in this most recent election cycle. In fact, I know a few men who ran for office. I'm sure each candidate probably felt like they were running uphill. Those 30-second commercials can be devastating. Maybe you were watching a game or a news show, and one of those 30-second commercials came up, sponsored by whichever party is sponsoring it, and it effectively says a few things about the candidate, but attempts to fully demolish the opponent. And if you're like me, you watch that commercial and you're left thinking, man, that person is a lousy person. I can't believe they did that or said that or believed that. And then a few minutes later, the other side sends up their 30-second commercial and you're left saying, I can't believe how terrible they are. In fact, after watching these commercials, you're convinced both of them ought to be put into prison forever and never seen again. Well, you've come to expect that kind of activity during a political campaign. In fact, the higher the stakes and the closer you get to election day, the more mud goes flying through the air. Party politics, unfortunately, is part of politics. You've come to expect that in an election, for good or bad. What you don't expect is to find that in the assembly. Rivalry in the world is one thing. Rivalry in the church is another. The truth is, a party spirit, a factious, divisive spirit, is more devastating in the church than in any political campaign or, in fact, in the political world. For one thing, playing politics in the body of Christ is never out of season. You don't have to wait 2 years or 4 years to scoop up some mud and throw it. You get a pass year-round. Throwing mud is always in season. And it can get ugly. Not just in politics, but in the pews of the average evangelical church. The problem isn't new for politicians, and it isn't new for the church either. In fact, the Apostle Paul is about to reveal a divided church in Rome. If you'll take your New Testament letter of Paul to the Philippians, we're in chapter 1. We're going to discover this. While you're turning, you might remember that the Apostle Paul has delivered some good news. His imprisonment in Rome looked like it was taking him backward. It was actually moving the gospel forward. That's the good news. Now he's going to deliver some unfortunate news. Let's back up into verse 14 and get a running start. Philippians chapter 1. And most of the brothers, you could render that brothers and sisters, have become confident in the Lord by my imprisonment, are much more bold to speak the word without fear. Now here's the bad news. Some preach Christ from envy and rivalry, but others from goodwill. The latter do it out of love, knowing that I am put here for the defense of the gospel. The former proclaim Christ out of rivalry, not sincerely, but thinking, hoping, planning to afflict me in my imprisonment. Now, here's what's happening in a nutshell. Paul's imprisonment in Rome has created division. In fact, there is a majority and a minority. The majority are accusing Paul of certain things and have created this party spirit, this divisive spirit. In fact, it's sort of turned into something like an election campaign. And church leaders are actually leading the way, as if they were running for office. Now, we'll get into the details in a moment, but let me first off alert you to the fact that we're about to witness the Apostle Paul with mud splattered over his body, his face, so to speak. We're about to watch Paul respond to accusations, to misinterpretations, to a factious party spirit that is in earnest in the pew. Now, as we go back and unpack what we just read, I want to point out several actions in Paul's response to all of this. Paul is covered in mud, but he's about to model a godly response to this factious attitude. In fact, we're going to discover why we should imitate Paul, and we're going to find him imitating Jesus Christ. So if you're keeping an outline, let me put it this way. Let me give you five ways to model a good response to mud. Okay? Number one. First, Paul openly identifies the problem. Now, we're almost back to looking at the paragraph. Let me say one other introductory comment. As hard as it is for us to imagine today, Paul was not well received in Rome. In fact, if your view of Paul is that he's this amazingly beloved apostle, if your conception is that there were balloons and banners when he arrived, think again. That's a misconception. You need to understand that this veteran missionary and church planter, the ambassador of God to the Gentiles, was actually beloved by a few and disliked by the majority. Now here in verse 15, Paul reveals the two sides. Notice again, some preach Christ from envy and rivalry. This happens to be the majority. Now, the word for envy refers to not just wanting what someone else has, but this word actually refers to someone who is wishing the person who has it harm. That is, they don't just want to have what that person has, they really want the other person to be demolished, discredited. Their preaching, evidently, is including, you know, these 30-second commercials where they're intending not only to gather a following, but they're wanting to destroy the reputation of Paul. It's interesting that Chrysostom, the 4th century church leader, in one of his discourses, uses this same word here for envy in our New Testament text when he referred to those who are, and I quote, plotting against one another and gloating over the misfortune of their neighbors. Now you can imagine this taking place in the world, right? Surely not among people who represent God. I mean, it's one thing to envy what somebody might have. It's another thing to envy to the point that you really wish them harm. Well, let me just remind you of the religious leaders of Jesus' day. You remember how they were complaining and they're bellowing over how Jesus has upset the traditional cart and that he is not respecting the temple. In fact, he's threatening to destroy the temple and he's blasphemed God and he's not washing his hands and they need to protect their heritage. They need to protect, you know, their religion. We need to protect the sanctity of the temple. All that sounds great. Mark just kind of, in his gospel, Mark pulls down that mask and says, even Pilate knew that they were handing him over because of envy. Same word used here. The religious leaders really just wanted to protect their turf, their following. So Paul is openly declaring the truth that the envy of these leaders, these churches, even these pastors who are preaching Christ, and by the way, they do know and believe the gospel of Christ. It's clear these are not false teachers. This is not some sect or cult. These are pastors, teachers, leaders, churches that believe the gospel. They're preaching out of the self-centered, personally ambitious motive, and they are creating antagonism toward Paul. As hard as it is to believe, beloved, Paul is going to be ignored in Rome at best. He's going to be attacked by the believers in Rome at worst. And why? They're filled with envy. Paul has shown up in Rome and they've been fine without him. You know, send us a letter. Don't show up. They frankly don't want their little following to lose interest in them and potentially follow him. So Paul attributes this attribute or this characteristic to them. Now he goes further and he attributes a really devastating characteristic. Not only are they envious of Paul, he adds in verse 15, they are preaching with rivalry. Your translation may read selfish ambition or contention. One linguist wrote this word rivalry from Aretheia actually relates to political maneuvering and election intrigue. And when I translated that word and did a little study, that's what kind of set the theme as to what's happening here. In other words, these pastors and churches and leaders are canvassing for votes and attention and support, and Paul is in their way. He's on their turf. I mean, this is politics in the pew at its worst. And they're willing to go to any length to keep their churches from any sense of loyalty to the Apostle Paul, of all people. By the way, this explained for me something I've never quite understood. In fact, you might want to turn over, hold your finger here, and just turn over to 2 Timothy chapter 1. 2 Timothy chapter 1, where Paul writes something that I didn't quite understand until Philippians chapter 1. He says this, as he's writing, he is incarcerated. This is near the end of his life after spending several years in Rome. He says in verse 16 of 2 Timothy chapter 1, may the Lord grant mercy to the household of Onesiphorus, for he often refreshed me and was not ashamed of my chains. Note that in your memory. I'll refer to it again. He was not ashamed of my chains. Note this. But when he arrived in Rome, he searched for me earnestly and found me. Are you serious? Onesiphorus arrives in Rome and he has to search diligently to find out where Paul is staying? The churches and leaders have so completely abandoned Paul that a few years after he'd arrived, nobody even knows now where he's living. No wonder Paul comes to the last few lines of this same letter. If you look over chapter 4 and verse 16, and he says right in the middle of the verse, but all have deserted me. All have deserted me. And why? Back to Philippians chapter 1, envy. Envy, you've got something I don't have and I want it and I don't want you to have it anymore. Rivalry, you're getting more attention than me and I don't want you to have any of it because I want all of it. Envy and rivalry taking place not in a political campaign, but in the church, turning one Christian against another. Even worse, causing one Christian to throw mud at another one. That's the first faction or grouping. Notice the second faction back in chapter 1 of Philippians in verse 15. There are those who preach Christ from goodwill. Doesn't really need much of an explanation. Goodwill simply refers to someone desiring the best for Paul, someone thinking the best of Paul. So here you have Paul's honest and open identification of a major division in the body. This is politics in the pew. You've got this one group, the majority, envy and rivalry, and the other one clinging, choosing to cling to thinking the best of him. And for the most part, so few that nobody even knew where Paul was staying. Secondly, Paul boldly reveals their motive. He reveals their motive. There's something else going on. It isn't just envy and rivalry. He's actually going to dig a little deeper. He isn't just going to say there's a problem with envy and rivalry. He's going to tell us what the motive is behind that. He's going to take it to the tap root and show you. Look at verse 16. The latter, that is those who preach from goodwill, do it out of love, knowing that I am put here for the defense of the gospel. Apologia, the word defense, apologetics is the word we get from this. The other, that is the other faction, preach out of love, knowing that I am put here for the defense of the gospel. The former faction proclaimed Christ out of rivalry. So stop for a moment. Paul makes it clear the problem here is not the message. They're preaching the same message, the gospel of Christ. The problem is not their message. The problem is their motive. And Paul provides a clue as to perhaps why so many in the church in Rome are finding it easy to effectively bump him off their radar. Not even visit him. Bring a casserole or send a card or nothing. Just completely write him off. Notice the phrase in verse 16 again. The latter do it out of love. Watch this. Knowing that I am put here. That word, verb, put here, can be rendered appointed. They know I am appointed. I am destined by God to be in this place. In other words, the sympathetic believers who loved Paul understood that he had been appointed to imprisonment for the sake of an opportunity of teaching apologetics, defending the gospel. The verb was also used in the military world for someone receiving a special assignment. This was Paul's attitude. Now, I have to tell you, he must have at this point been very grateful for the church in Philippi, he's writing. Faithful supporters, those who were thinking the best of him. They knew he had been appointed for imprisonment by God. A few in Rome understood it as well, that his apartment and his handcuffs to that Praetorian guard were part of God's assignment. And that apartment was his classroom where he would teach apologetics, defend the gospel. Notice, on the other hand, this ambitious faction, verse 17, they have a different motive. He goes deeper than just envy or rivalry. Notice, their motive is actually, Paul writes at the end of verse 17, to afflict me in my imprisonment. Don't miss that. Their underlying motive, you could render it, is to make my bonds more galling. In other words, they want to pour salt in the wound. They want to make Paul's life miserable. And now you're thinking, okay, we got to be talking about a cult. We can't be talking about the church. We can't be talking about believers. Yes, we are. Yes, we are. Well, why in the world would a Christian, a pastor, a church leader, a believer, ever want to make Paul suffer even more? I personally think the clue is given to us in this deeper motive, and it tells us what's going on behind the scenes. First, let me just take you back to that scene. Historically, this is a culture in which a prison had a huge stigma attached to it, and a prison sentence would, for the most part, end your credibility forever. Much of that stigma has remained to this day. One historian writes of Paul's generation, Paul was certainly aware that his incarceration reflected negatively on his credibility. In other words, it's hard to say you're right when you're handcuffed. They understood that prison, this man writes, was a place of dishonor. Considerable pressure was exerted on those who knew a prisoner, get this, to treat him with revulsion or to abandon him entirely. Could that be the case with Paul? I think so. In fact, it explains Paul's remark to Timothy that I ask you to just tuck away in your memory, where he says to Timothy, when Onesiphorus came to see me, he was not ashamed of my chains. He wasn't ashamed. He was willing to bear the stigma of associating with me. Let me add to that another thought. Keep in mind, these Roman believers had certainly heard how God had rescued Paul earlier from prison. You remember that wonderful story, the earthquake and the chains fall off, the jailer gets saved. Man, that's a church, that's a story for the church, isn't it? That'll make, you know, the testimony meeting. Why not now? Why not now? I wonder. No miracle. Surely they had heard of Peter's miraculous escape. The angel appears, his chains fall off. He walks right through, past all the guards who didn't see him while we're sleeping, and That's God's work. That's great. Wait, that's not happening to Paul. He's stuck. He's been there for years, a couple of years now. I wonder. You can almost see where they're going. Their underlying motive of wanting Paul to suffer in prison was more than likely based on their belief that Paul's chains were his own doing. God would never allow his chief ambassador to languish for years in prison unless something was wrong with Paul himself. John MacArthur, in his commentary on Philippians, did a wonderful job just sort of imagining all the possible things that people could have been saying about Paul's imprisonment that would eventually cause them to abandon him. We know they did. He said it so well, I've just sort of edited it down from pages to a paragraph or two. Let me go through them quickly as bullet points. He said this, well, like Job's friends, counselors, there would have been envious preachers in Rome claiming that Paul's imprisonment was the Lord's punishment for some secret sin. I mean, if we could see behind the scenes, there's probably something going on. Or, still others might have thought that the Lord kept Paul in prison because of his inadequate and misleading preaching of God's word. God just needed to shut him up. Others may have thought that Paul was old-fashioned and that a more relevant approach was needed to reach the sophisticated people of Rome. He's outdated. Others may have argued that if Paul had been completely uncompromising and true to the faith, he would have been martyred long beforehand. He's evidently made a deal with the Romans to protect his life and secure favorable treatment. Many of them probably didn't know the Philippians were paying the rent on the apartment. Paul's in an apartment. He's got a deal going on. He's saving his neck. Still others might have maintained that Paul was in prison because he lacked the victorious faith that would have gained his release. His prayers in the past were more powerful. Now they aren't. He's still imprisoned. He's obviously failing to tap into the Holy Spirit's power. Others would have claimed that the very fact that they were free to preach and Paul was in prison was proof enough that God was finished with Paul and was now going to use them instead. It's well put. Paul is out of the way, and now those of us who matter to God can get on with it. Those who loved Paul, were willing to think the best, knew he wasn't in prison because of secret sin or an impure life or a lack of faith or because God's Spirit was finished with him. No, in fact, beloved, listen, these Philippian believers would have known that Paul is receiving his most difficult assignment from God ever. An appointment from God that would require the greatest faith. An assignment that would depend upon the purest life, the most persevering trust in the Spirit of God that he has not abandoned him. Listen to what he wrote Timothy during these days. I only read you the first part so I could save this part until now. He writes with chains around his wrists to Timothy just months before his execution. And he says, everyone has deserted me but the Lord stood by me and strengthened me. These chains are not a disgrace. They are a grace from God for his gospel and his glory. Paul openly identifies the problem. He boldly reveals the motive. And I think we can begin to appreciate now the third point, and that is this. Paul graciously resists retaliation. Verse 18. Take your New Testaments or your iPhones. Look at that first phrase. What then? Stop there. That's a sermon. Oh, it was tempting. But I know you're praying for me to move forward. What then? You could translate that, so what? Well, so what? What about it? In other words, what does it really matter if I'm loved or hated? This is God's assignment. Maybe for you, beloved, this morning, this is the message you need from God more than any other right now. Those handcuffs, those chains, those misunderstandings, those misinterpretations, that dishonor, that abandonment. You came in here, we can't see it, but you're splattered with mud. Verse 18, look, it should have opened with something more like, well, let me tell you a thing or two. Let me set the record straight and go on for a chapter or two. Wait till I get a hold of you guys. I mean, he could have skinned these Roman Christians alive. But he resists self-defense, self-promotion. He could have rattled off his resume. Have you forgotten who I am? The apostle of God to the Gentiles? Have you forgotten my epistle? Have you forgotten my past? He could have reminded them of it all. No, that's how you respond. If you want to jump into the political fracas, and Paul refuses to play the game. Preaching Christ is not a race for spiritual scalps. It isn't a contest to see how and who gets the most delegates on the convention floor. Paul refuses to play pastoral politics in the parish, among the pews. He won't join their game. And you're left thinking, no, Paul, they've abandoned you. You should hear what they're saying. You should hear what they've concluded. He knows. He knows. For those of you who lead a ministry or part of a ministry in leadership, for those of you who step up to serve as elders, for those of you who volunteer to serve as deacons, for those who lead a men's Bible study or a woman's Bible study or an ABF, you volunteer to set up the soccer nets on Saturday, and you're leading in that, and or you're volunteering to lead the PTA. The question is not, will you ever hear criticism? The question is not, will you ever feel the sting of mud? The question is not, will you ever feel the pain of lonely perseverance? The question is not, will you ever be the subject of misunderstanding? The question is not, will it happen to you? The question is, how will you respond when it happens, and it will? How do you handle the mud? How do you handle the mud splattered on your face? As many of you know, I enjoy reading biographies. In many ways, it's simply reading the suffering of others and how they respond. And I encourage it for your own spiritual discipline. But I've often wondered how I would respond were I given the amazing breadth of ministry like that of Charles Spurgeon, who would preach on a Sunday to thousands of people. And his church in London, England was a wonderful church. Still communicating the gospel to this day, 150 years later. But Spurgeon would receive every Monday morning by courier an anonymous letter of a man ripping his sermon to shreds. Now, not that sermons are beyond criticism. They are not. Or pastors. Or leaders. But I've often thought, every Monday? Every Monday. I rather enjoy the story of D.L. Moody, who preached for Spurgeon. Moody pastored in Chicago, as you know. And he was often the recipient of derogatory, demeaning mail, often, most often anonymous, all sorts of accusations. He was picked on for everything from his lack of education. He only went through, I think, the eighth grade. His grammar was interesting. And his bearing and appearance. On one occasion, he was sitting on a platform about to preach to several thousand people. He was a guest somewhere. And an usher came up and handed him a note. It was folded over once. Moody opened the note, and it only contained one word: fool. He folded the note back. In a moment or two, he stepped up to preach, and he brought the note with him, and he said, "You know, I have a note with me with a single word, fool, written here. I often receive unkind messages that are unsigned. The strangest thing, the author's forgotten to write me a message, but has merely signed his name." That's probably not the best illustration of refusing to retaliate, but I knew you'd enjoy that as much as I did. Chuck Swindoll, in one of his books that I read recently, said, "What do we do when a harsh word is spoken to us or about us? We usually shout back louder." The truth is, if Paul had chosen to retaliate, he would have had far more mud to throw back, and it would have stuck. He refuses to shout back. Here's why. Number four, Paul wisely refocuses the priority. What then? What of it? What about it? "Only that in every way, whether in pretense, that is out of rivalry and envy, or in truth, that is out of goodwill and love, Christ is proclaimed," that's the issue, "in that I," what? "Rejoice." "In that I rejoice. Even if they preach out of pretense, false motives, rivalry, envy, competition, accusation, even if they preach Christ in truth, out of goodwill and love for me, as long as the gospel is preached, in that," the priority, "I will rejoice." I mean, at this point in the text, especially when we've come to understand Paul's painful circumstances, you would almost forgive him for at least a verse that says, "Oh man, are these guys a pain in the neck? I am hurt." He does that, by the way, to the Corinthians. Bears his soul. Here he wants to focus on the priority. This is a short letter, not much time. But you need to understand here what you would expect is some sort of depressed, discouraged, despairing acknowledgement. But Paul isn't Superman. He's not wearing a Teflon outfit. He simply has a grip on his assignment from God and an understanding of the priority. Even though the church had written him off, even though pastors and church leaders and Christians in Rome didn't come to see him or encourage him, or worse, they're telling everybody, "Yeah, you know, that old Paul is out of touch. He's probably guilty of some sin that only God knew, and he's getting what he deserves, and he's out of the way anyway. It's time for us to get moving." Paul is effectively saying, "I'm aware of that. I know the deeper recesses of their motive. But as long as they are preaching the gospel of Christ, I rejoice." Wow. There's one more way to handle the mud that gets thrown your way. Number five, Paul intentionally shapes his attitude. Notice the last statement of verse 18, and my text is sort of tucked into verse 19, still a part of verse 18. Underline that. Marvel over this. Learn from this. He ends this text by saying, "Yes, and I will rejoice. As if to say, in case you wondered if you read it right, as long as Christ is proclaimed, in that I rejoice. I want to make sure you get it. Yes, I did say it. I will rejoice. The verb is what linguists call volitive. That means it's a verb that refers to the decision of the will, of volition. It doesn't mean that Paul, you know, you might be tempted to think he's just such a happy guy. Wow. 2 years under house arrest, handcuffs, the whole deal, people accusing him, and he just wakes up on the sunny side of life. No. Read his letters. He is saying here on this occasion, however, I want to make sure you get it. I am choosing to rejoice. In fact, this is a future tense verb, which means Paul is saying that this is his decision, not just for the moment while he's writing a letter to believers, because really the missionary letter ought to look like this. He's saying, I'm going to take this attitude into the future with me as well. Which lets you know that all of those other pastors and church leaders and Christians are fighting on their feet. Paul is effectively fighting this battle on his knees. It's the only place you can find this kind of strength. Everyone's deserted me, but the Lord stood with me. It is tragic, and I do want to add a thought here, that these believers in Rome really had no idea, did they? In fact, many of them really didn't know Paul all that well. We forget that we have the benefit of the entire New Testament. We can study his missionary letters, travels, his visions, his tour of heaven, his assignment. We can even know that the Philippians are paying for that apartment, which would have created misinterpretation. He's in the pocket of the Roman government. We knew it! No? There are some Christians that are paying his rent. We have that benefit. Most of the believers in Rome would have no idea. Many of them would have just reached the assumption, I guess this old apostle isn't all that valuable to God or the church anymore, and God's moved on, and we will too. Can you imagine the Apostle Paul just two blocks away for 2 years and we could go see him? I mean, wouldn't that be great? Wouldn't it be great to go to Paul and say, you know, you wrote this stuff in Romans 8, 9, and 10, but I'd really like you to just clear up election. Let's take an hour or two or three or four. I'd really like you to explain the battle that you expressed in your letter to the Romans in chapter 7. The things I want to do, I don't do. The things I don't want to do, I do. Would you fill in some blanks there? Because there are a lot of people that don't think you were talking about yourself. I wonder what we're missing today with each other. None of them came to see him. But they all rallied to accuse him. Let's do the opposite, beloved. It may not be the apostle you're throwing mud at. Maybe another Christian or believer, but learn the lesson, not only of Paul's wonderful response, learn a lesson from the tragic mistake of these believers in Rome and what they missed. Whenever you throw mud, you are taking your eyes off the greater priority, the gospel of Jesus Christ. I want to end with a little bit from Spurgeon's biography. You can pack your things away. We're pretty much done, and we're going to be over time, and you're going to want to go to lunch so you can lace up your boots, and we're almost done, right? Let me give you an illustration from Spurgeon's life again. During the 1800s, he pastored this downtown church in London, and it had enormous weight as a leading voice for the gospel. The church would develop institutions and ministries that are remarkable even to read of this day. In fact, I'll give you one. It wasn't in my notes. It just came to my mind. One was an orphanage that he built, and he just didn't build an orphanage. He built a magnificent place to occupy these orphans. And on the bottom floor, he built an indoor heated swimming pool. And he was vilified for it. How can you waste that money? An orphan wouldn't say that. He gave them the best. At any rate, during his later years of ministry, Spurgeon denounced the growing liberalism within the Baptist Union, which he belonged to and his church belonged to. There were pastors now. The majority of them were denying inspiration of Scripture. They were denying the sufficiency of Christ's atonement, and works was creeping into the plan of salvation. And since Spurgeon's voice carried such significant weight, all of the pastors and churches in London, when he challenged them and their doctrine, they responded with anger. In fact, in his magazine that they published as a church, he called on the Baptist Union to do a cleanup of their doctrine. Well, it created a firestorm, as you can imagine. Over the years, envy had done its silent work in many of these men's hearts. And now, instead of rising to Spurgeon's warning and challenge, these church leaders and pastors instead turned around and challenged Spurgeon, accusing him of exercising authority he didn't have, and that he didn't have the right to challenge them, and all he did was make them look foolish. It wasn't his intention. Spurgeon, over the months when this firestorm was raging, resigned from the Baptist Union. And that only made these leaders more angry. A movement grew within the Baptist Union to censure Spurgeon. Doesn't mean there's a whole lot to us today, but back in that day, that could affect your credit rating and the borrowing of money and your housing and certainly your reputation. And they wanted to publicly denounce him, diminish his standing among the believing churches in and around London and beyond. A meeting was called. It met at the Temple Church, the second largest church in London, pastored by Joseph Parker. One man by the name of Henry Oakley attended the meeting and fortunately wrote down in detail what happened. He described the bedlam of that meeting that afternoon with several thousand in attendance. He wrote, "Possibly the city temple was as full as it could be. I was there very early, but found only room in the aisle of the back gallery. I listened to the speeches. The only one of which I have any remembrance was a pastor who spoke in favor of a liberal theology and the justification of doubt. A moment came when the motion to censure Spurgeon was moved and seconded, and then the vote came. When the motion came up, then a forest of hands, when the vote was called, went up, thousands of hands. Anyone against the motion? Called the chairman. But I did not see any hands. All the history records there were seven, only seven who voted not to censure Spurgeon. Oakley writes, without any tally of numbers or announcement, it was obvious. And the vast assembly broke into tumultuous cheering and cheering and cheering. From some of the older men, I saw their pent-up hostility and envy against Spurgeon found full vent. It was a strange scene. I viewed it almost with tears. I stood near a graduate from Spurgeon's own college, whom I knew very well. Mr. Spurgeon had welcomed him from a very lowly position, and he was going wild with delight at this censure of his generous teacher. I say it was a strange scene that this vast assembly should be so outrageously delighted at the condemnation of the noblest and grandest leader of their faith." End quote. When he learned of the vote, Spurgeon wrote a friend and ended it by writing, "Pray for me that my faith fail not. He would fight the battle on his knees. Today, Charles Spurgeon is revered as the most effective English pastor in the last 150 years. His sermons are still being published, even the ones that were ripped apart every Monday morning. And today, the Apostle Paul is revered as the greatest missionary statesman and defender of the faith in the history of the church, and it isn't going to change. J. Oswald Sanders wrote in his classic work entitled Spiritual Leadership, "The crowd at large does not recognize a leader until they are usually gone, and then they build a monument for him with the stones they threw at him when he was alive. When mud comes flying through the air in your direction, don't stoop to throw it back. Don't throw it back. Identify the problem. Clarify the motive with those that need to know. Refuse to retaliate. Refocus on the priority and intentionally choose while you're on your knees. Make a choice to rejoice so that in the end and ultimately Jesus Christ receives glory and the gospel moves forward." Amen.